We're continuing our study in the book of Judges today. We're going to be in chapters 4 and 5 that really deal with the same incident. Chapter 4 is a prose section, and chapter 5 is poetry. It's been interesting to me through the years, since there's been so much controversy about the historicity of these early parts of the Bible, that when I find historical corroboration in archaeology, it is interesting to me to share it with you. We have recently found some ancient Egyptian documents that do this very same thing. Tell an account in a prose section and then retell it in a poetry section. And what I mean to say by that is Joshua fits in to the literary techniques of his day. I want to tell you, the more archaeology makes discoveries in the ancient Near East, the more the historicity of the Bible is confirmed. This chapter 4 continues the shocking, vicious cycle of the people of God. Notice, then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And this evil, again, is getting involved in this Canaanite fertility worship. The very thing that caused the Canaanites to be judged and removed from their land is what Israel, God's people, are doing. God told them, kill all of them, or they're going to be a thorn in your side and a sticker in your eye. And oh my, were they. And the Lord sold them. Now this is exactly the opposite of the word redeemed. The word redeemed means to buy them back. He sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. Now this has caused some real consternation among commentators, because back in Joshua chapter 11, Jabin, the king of Hazor, was defeated. And that's just the same thing here. We learn from verse 10 that this is the area of Hazor. Joshua 11:10. Well, what do we do? Well, I think the best explanation possible, and if you're looking for a book that kind of deals with these Old Testament historical difficulties, I think the Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties by Gleason Archer would be very helpful. Also, F.F. Bruce, Questions on the Bible, is an excellent little book. It's out of print. This particular case, I think Jabin must be a name like Hadad for the Syrian king, Pharaoh for the Egyptian king, later on a Caesar for the Roman kings. So there were several of these Jabins. The other thing I think happened is that although Joshua probably broke the back of this military resistance, there wasn't enough Israelis to occupy all these cities, and this place may have been re-inhabited by Canaanites. We're just not real sure. Notice it says, who reigned in Hazor. Now Hazor, we know, is a huge archaeological site. Megiddo is about 40 acres. Hazor is 240 acres. It is a monster ruins about 8.5 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. And the commander of his army was Sisera. Now, Sisera is not a Hebrew name, and it's not a Canaanite name. We're not really sure his racial origin. Who lived, and the city here is somewhat uncertain, but the last of this, the Ha-Goyim, is simply the word for the nations. Jews later used that Goyim as a kind of a reference to all those who were non-Jewish. And the sons of Israel cried out to Yahweh, their covenant God, and look what he did. Even amidst this vicious cycle, for he had, Sisera had 900 chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. Now, this doesn't mean 900 chariots made completely of iron. It's not really iron. It's another type of amalgamated metal. But it does mean that the accessories of these chariots were metal. Basically, the frame would have been wooden, but the rest would have been metal. We learn from 1 Samuel, I believe it's verse 19. I'm going to find it later on here. When I find that, I'll quote it to you. That the Israelites, even in the time of Saul, still didn't have smelters in their land. So the Philistines, by having iron later on, were formidable. And this Canaanite city, by having iron implements, was very formidable. It'd be the ultimate military weapon of their day. 900 chariots. My word, what a large army. So obviously they controlled the valleys. Now the chariots couldn't get up in the hills, but they controlled the coastal plain and the valleys. Verse 4. Now Deborah, a prophetess. Now the word Deborah means honeybee. That's kind of cute, isn't it? A prophetess. There's been so much consternation in our day over women leaders in the church. I want to say here's a good example of God using a lady to judge all of his people in the Old Testament. There are several Old Testament prophets. We have Miriam, of course, Exodus 15:20. She's called a prophet. We have Huldah, an excellent woman prophet, in 2 Kings 22, I believe, 14. We have a false prophet, but still a lady, Noada mentioned in Nehemiah 6:14. We have a godly woman who acted like a prophet, Anna, in the New Testament, Luke 2:36. We have Phoebe, who's called a deaconess at the Church of Cenchrea, Romans 16:1. We have Philip's seven daughters, who are all called evangelists, in Acts 21:9. And we have the widow's role, which we would call, I think, like deaconesses, in 1 Timothy chapter 3, particularly verse 11. God has always used gifted women. I realize that Paul says that we must keep quiet in the church, and that's a theme is repeated in several different places in the New Testament. But I think there has to be some local conditioning, a period conditioning. I'm not sure it's a universal principle that God never used women in place of leadership because we have them listed throughout the Bible. I would say to you that I think Galatians chapter 3, verse 26 through 29 is a significant statement about the equality of men and women, slave and free, Jew or Greek, in Jesus Christ. Men and women are both gifted, and we need to use our gifts for the Lord. I realize that there is an order in creation between men and women going back to Genesis, but I also realize that in Jesus Christ we're all one and we're all gifted. I don't have an easy answer for that, but I think Deborah ought to help us find a way to it. Now, it says, at the wife of, and here's an unusual word. It means torches. Now, some have identified him with Barak, because his name means lightning. But I think that's far-fetched. This is not a feminine form, as some of the commentators say, but it is an abstract noun ending, which makes it look like a feminine form. Was judging Israel at that time. And, of course, judging is not so much, we think, a judge, but like a defender, someone like that. And she used to sit under the palm tree. Now, the trees were holy sites, as you know, because they showed the presence of water. Remember how during all of Abraham, the oaks of Mamre and the like? Of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. We're not sure what tribe she's from, but she seems to be of the tribe of Ephraim, like Joshua. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. And, of course, that shows that all the tribes had some kind of unity, and she is the one that was the leader during this period. And she sent and summoned a Barak. Now, his word means lightning. And he comes from Kadesh Naphtali. Now, of course, this is up in the affected area. You know, you get a map in the back of your Bible that shows the division of the tribes, and you'll see how Zebulun and Naphtali are up in this northern region. And from chapter 4, it seems like only they were involved. Now, from the poem in chapter 5, it shows that other tribes were involved also. And he tells him to go up and to a... oh, by the way, I want to mention to you in verse 6. Isn't it funny that in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, that Barak is mentioned but not Deborah? Well, that's a Jewish bias even in Hebrews. I'm not sure why Deborah's not mentioned. Now, he's to go up to Mount Tabor. Now, if you look at your map, Mount Tabor, if you kind of go to the Sea of Galilee, go down a little bit and over toward the Mediterranean, you will see that Mount Tabor is the only topological rise in this area called the Valley of Megiddo. It's also called the Plain of Ashkelon, and it's also called Armageddon. Okay, it's kind of like one bald hill. If you've ever been to Israel, it's just one tall little hill. And that's where this army went because the chariots couldn't go up there. It was forested this period. And, of course, these two tribes that are affected by that area gather together to help him there. And I will draw out Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, and his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon. Now, look at your map again. That's the river that flows right through that valley where Megiddo is. And I will give him into your hand. And Barak said to her, "Not on your life, sister. I ain't going unless you go." And she says, "I'll go with you. I'll go with you." But look at verse 9. "But the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." You say, "Oh, Deborah's going to get the honor." No. No. Verse 11 is introducing a Kenite tribe that should be in the south with Judah, but is located way north up here around Mount Tabor in Megiddo. And then we're going to be listening to a lady named Jael, or Yael. And she's the one that's going to get the victory. Not Deborah, not Barak, but God's going to use another lady. "And Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh." Now, this is not Kadesh Barnea, which is way down the south, south of Beersheba even, in Judah. This is Kadesh Naphtali, the hometown of Barak. Okay? Now, "And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali and together to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up with him, and Deborah went up with him." Now, look at verse 11. Verse 11 is like a paragraph all to itself. Why? Verse 11 is going to introduce verses 17 through 22. How did this Kenite tribe get so far out of its normal place? Now, Heber, the Kenite, of course, Kenite is the same name we learn from chapter 1, verse 16. It can also mean Midianite. Moses' father-in-law was of this same group. But now we'll see Numbers 10:29. But also Caleb's family and Othniel, they were also a Kenite family that settled within Judah. And this seems to be a relative of theirs. From the sons of Hobad. Now, Hobad, as you know, Numbers 10:29, is another name for Moses' father-in-law. Hobad, Reuel, Jether, Jethro, all refer to the same guy. The father-in-law of Moses has pitched his tent far away at the oaks of Zananim, which is near Kadesh. Now, we'll see Joshua 19:33. Okay, it's on the border of Naphtali. Okay, it's one of these northern regions. So they told Sisera that Barak had gone to Mount Tabor, and Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, his whole army. He went out to kill these 10,000. And Deborah said to Barak, "Arise, for this day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands." Now, what happened? Well, I think it's very interesting. What God's going to do, he's going to use apparently a frog-strangling rainstorm. And it's going to come down on this valley, and these iron chariots that are very heavy are going to bog down the mud. Have you ever tried to walk in mud and your shoes pick up a little mud and pick up a little mud? And pretty soon you just got to, your shoes are so heavy with so much mud. Happened to these chariots. These chariots are going to become totally unusable. The people panic and jump out of their chariots and run. And these Israelis got a hold of them, I want to tell you. You see that in verse 15. They routed. We learn from chapter 5, verses 4 and 5 and 21 about this rainstorm, though it's not mentioned specifically in chapter 4. And Barak's going to pursue them all the way from the place they left, Hagoyim, and all of them are going to die. To the last man, they're going to die. It's almost like this holy war deal. Look at verse 17. Now, Sisera, he jumped out, got on his foot, jumped out of his chariot, and he was running away, right? Now, he went by the tent of this Kenite family. And one of these ladies, Jael, said, the wife of Heber, said, come here, I'll help you. Come here, turn aside. Now, apparently they had separate tents, and apparently he went into her tent and was hiding in her tent. And she covered him with a rug, and he said, oh, can I have something to drink? And she gave him a little milk. Now, my New American Standard says a bottle of milk, but of course it's a skin of milk. There's no bottles back here. And she covered him up again. I guess he was tired from running. He went to sleep. And you know who puts the tents up in an Arabic society? Nomadic society, Bedouin society? The women do, folks. I want to tell you, this lady, she'd been putting this tent up, and she got this tent peg and got a mallet, and as he was sleeping, she just walked up and boom, right through his temple, right into the ground, died right there. And then she came, and when the other men were running by, Barak and his soldiers, she said, come here, I want to show you something. And in her tent, there was this dead guy there underneath the cover. And boy, you think, boy, she lied to him and said she'd hide him. What's the deal here? Well, she's a real hero, and she's the one, I think, that referring to the woman had the victory is the Lord's prophecy. Now, notice in verse 23, it says, the Lord subdued that day Jabin, king of the Canaanites, we know as Hazor, before the sons of Israel. And the hands of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king. Now, this shows it's not just a one-time thing. There must have been many skirmishes. The city of Hazor didn't fall right now like it did in Joshua, but little by little they possessed their own land is what this is referring to. Now, chapter 5 is basically the poetry of this same thing. It seems like that it says it's a song of Deborah and Barak that they're singing, and the word song is used throughout here. You see it in verse 3 twice. You see it down in verse 12. You see it in latter part of verse 10. But because of verse 12, it says, awake, awake, Deborah, it seems like someone else had a part in writing this song. I think it's the experience of Deborah, but maybe someone else wrote it for her. Or maybe there's a chorus in here where a group of singers come in and kind of encourage the song along. I'm not sure. Notice in verse 2, the leaders led in Israel. Now, the word leaders here is locks hung loose in Israel. And what does that mean? Well, they had long hair. I know that bothers all you rednecks. But the truth is that the Israeli army had red hair because they were dedicated to God. It was a sign of their dedication. Going back to Numbers chapter 6, the Nazarite vow. You might want to see a couple of the places where this long hair is used as a symbol of dedication to God. Deuteronomy 32:42. 2 Samuel 14:26, Ezekiel 44:20. You might even want to see Acts 18:18 for Paul not cutting his hair because of a limited Nazarite vow. That's discussed also in Numbers chapter 6. And the people volunteered. Now, there was no central government. We see this same volunteer spirit down in verse 9. The tribes got together because they wanted to rally to the Lord. Now, this man had superior military hardware, superior numbers. It was an act of real faith to want to go to war with having no metal implements of war and no chariots. And it was an act of faith. It was volunteer. And notice verse 3. Hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. These are imperatives in Hebrew, strong commands. And I, to the Lord, I will sing. I will sing praise to the Lord, the God of Israel. Here's the praise begins. Lord, when thou didst go out from Seir, that's Mount Seir apparently, connected with Edom, and thou didst march from the field of Edom. Now apparently there is some connection between Mount Sinai and Edom in some passages. As you know, the exact location of Mount Sinai is uncertain. Some put it down in the wilderness of Sin, in the bottom of the Sinai Plains, the traditional location. But others put it somewhere around Edom, around Paran, the wilderness of Paran. We're not real sure, but I want you to look up these other references to show there is a connection with Edom and Mount Sinai. Deuteronomy 33:2 and Habakkuk 3:3 and following links it to Edom. Now, the earth quaked, the heavens also dripped, even the clouds dripped water. Look at verse 5. The mountains quaked. Now, the word here for quaked in the Masoretic text is the word flowed. Here we have three references to water. Now, through this poem, it's going to be very important that you compare translations. This is a book that's put out by AMG in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The New Testament's edited by Curtis Vaughn. This happens to be volume 1 of the Old Testament. It's called 26 Translations of the Bible. And what it does is gives you King James in bold black print. And then from a pool of 26 possible translations, it gives you 4 or 5 alternate translations. There are several problems with the Hebrew in the sense we don't know exactly how to translate it in chapter 5. And comparing other translations or having a research tool like this will be very, very helpful. So I think instead of the word quaked in my New American Standard, it should be flowed. Now, notice it says, verse 6, in the days of Shamgar, son of Anath. Well, that's that little reference we found back in chapter 3, verse 31, and this is the only other place it's mentioned, you see. As chapter 3 talked about problems in the south, chapter 4 and 5 are about problems in the north of the Promised Land. It's kind of a geographical setting there. And then in the second part of verse 6, it says, in the day of Jael, the highways were deserted. Now, this seems to mean the caravan routes were not used. Now, some say, well, the camel wasn't domesticated until the 12th century B.C., but we have some archaeological evidence from Albright that says that the ghetto was destroyed around 1125, and this had to happen there. It kind of depends on your date of the Exodus. If you believe the Exodus is 1245, then 1125 is too late. If you believe the Exodus is 1290, that kind of fits into that theory. I'm not real sure about that. But notice this is that there was a problem because of these invaders and other peoples and maybe heavy taxation. There was no trade going on. Notice verse 7. The peasantry ceased. This means the rural poor farmers. They ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose. Now, if you look at some other translations, the RSV and the Jerusalem Bible, they all have you. Well, this is an archaic form of you that can be translated I, Deborah, or you, Deborah. And again, it depends on who you think the author is there in verse 7. Verse 8, new gods were chosen. Well, obviously, it's a reference to idolatry is what caused this problem. They went after the other gods, the gods of Canaan. Notice it says, then war was in the gates being the place of the justice, the place of decisions for government, that kind of thing. Place of social meeting. Not a shield nor a spear was seen. Now, this, remember I told you earlier about there was no smelters or metalworks in Israel? I found that reference. It's 1 Samuel 13, 19 through 22. This is later in the time of Saul. But what it's saying here is these folks had effectively disarmed the Israeli population. Somehow they didn't have the implements of war they needed, at least not the metal implements they needed to fight. Among the 40,000 in Israel. Now, this 40,000 probably refers to the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun, but we're not sure about that. It doesn't say that. Notice the volunteers thing is mentioned here again in verse 9. Verse 10, you who ride on white donkeys and sit on rich carpets. Now, donkeys were the noble animal of choice for the Israelis. It was the king had his own donkey. So it was a noble thing. It was a sign of wealth to ride on a donkey. To have a white donkey, man, that was like having a gold Cadillac, I want to tell you. Now, this is where it says rich carpets. I think it's probably talking about saddle bags. You can see in Judges 10:4 and Judges 12:14 how the wealthy rode on these fancy donkeys. And that's the reference here to the wealthy. Verse 11, at the sound of those who divide flocks among the watering places. Now, again, you need to compare several translations because the Revised Standard Version says this refers to music. The ASV, American Standard Version, says this refers to archers. This Hebrew word usually means archers. I'm not sure exactly what the reference here. It's something about water holes, either those who lie in ambush, archers, or those musical vagabonds who would come and entertain at the water holes. We're just not sure. The Hebrew word is just, I'm not sure. Verse 11, though, does seem to imply a place of safety and not a place of ambush. So maybe it's either musicians or those who divide the flock, shepherds. Now look at verse 12. Awake, awake, Deborah. That seems to imply another author of this song, or maybe somebody who's a chorus. Notice it says, arise, Barak, and take away your captives. It might be interesting if you look in the marginal note of your reference Bible. And if you're a teacher type, you need a reference Bible. This is quoted quite often in the New Testament. This is used in Ephesians 4 to describe what Jesus did when he resurrected from the dead. You might want to look at some of these passages. It's quoted again in Psalm 68, 17 and 18, Ephesians 4, 8 through 10, and Colossians 2, 15. So it's used a lot in the New Testament. Now, let's notice Amalek is mentioned in verse 14. From Ephraim, those whose root is in Amalek came down. Now, Amalek is one of those desert nomadic tribes that the Jews just hated because during the Exodus period, this tribe would attack the stragglers of the Israeli group. The older people, the children, they would kill them and harass the fringes of the camp, and the Jews hated them for that. This is one of the places, and I don't like to do it very much to the Masoretic text or the Hebrew text, but if you change one Hebrew letter, you get the idea they sprang from the valley. Now, the RSV follows that translation, and the New English Bible and the Jerusalem Bible are similar to that translation. They leave the word Amalek out and put that Judah, Ephraim, sprang into the valley, and that seems to be what it's referred to here. Now, Makar is a reference to Manasseh here. We see only two tribes mentioned in chapter 4, but there's a series of tribes mentioned in chapter 5. Maybe there were small groups, so more than just the two tribes affected. Notice this first chieftain, Makar, commanders came down. That's referring to Manasseh. And Zebulun, those who wield the staff of the office. We feel like this is a name for those who are responsible for taking in army officers, scribes that wrote down people's name who were volunteering for war, something like that. And notice several more of the tribes are mentioned through here. In verse 15 it says, into the valley they rushed at his heels. Now this is a Hebrew way of saying they went in close military formation, a marching order, if you please. Verse 16 is not too complimentary to Reuben. It says that, and if I can paraphrase it, Reuben's having all these secret meetings. They got a committee together to worry about, to talk about the situation. They talked a lot and did nothing. That's what Reuben did. Gilead, of course, is one of those trans-Jordan areas. It's the home of Gad. Notice it says, why did Dan stay in ships? Now, Dan's tribal allocation was along the coast down by Judah. And that's a reference here. They hadn't all moved to the north, as they will later in the book of Judges. And since Dan's right on the seacoast, this shows that the Jews had a limited amount of shipping even this early. Now, Solomon will have extensive shipping, especially in the Gulf of Aqaba, but this is the first reference to Dan that we have. Notice in verse 19, it talks about Megiddo. And then it says, the stars fought from heaven. There's two things either there. Either that God's more powerful than the astral deities, or it's a reference to this rainstorm that somehow caused the chariots to bog down. Not sure which. The torrents of Kishon swept them away, verse 21. So it seems like the reference to the heavens is referring to this rainstorm, but we can't be certain there. Again, the last of verse 21, look at several translations. There's a different way to do that. Let's see. Notice this, verse 23, a city is mentioned. It says, cursed by the angel of the Lord. This city would not come to fight. They wouldn't volunteer to come help the Lord. And here they're castigated because of their lack of faith. In verse 24 is really a reference back to chapter 4, verse 11 and verse 17 and 22 about the Jael, the wife, the Kenite wife of Heber, and all that she did in killing Sisera. And you might want to read that again. And then in verse 28, it talks, it's kind of sarcasm, verse 28 through 31, about the mother of Sisera, worried about he didn't come home. Where is my boy? Where is my boy? And of course, he's dead. And notice it says, a maiden, two maidens for every warrior. And that's the idea. They've defeated the Israelites. They're taking their women. But no, it's just the other way around. Sisera, to the Sisera, the spoil of dried work. Now, we know that the captain of the army got a special kind of garment. Usually one of these Babylonian garments, and a very beautiful, fancy dyed, beautiful patterns. It was kind of a way of saying, here, commander, here's your tribute. And so the mother's thinking, oh, I bet Sisera got one of these pretty garments. But no, what Sisera got is dead. That's what he got. And so, let's see. You can see that sarcasm and read through it about how God utterly destroyed them. And it says the land was undisturbed for 40 years. We've seen this pattern of 40-year rest and 80-year rest. 40 years is kind of the period of a generation. And so God is, if we mirror back in the first part of Judges, God is testing every generation to see if they'll trust Him. But God help us, no generation trusted Him until they got under pressure. And then they called out to God. I want to tell you the truth. I think that pressure in our lives is a gift from God. For when we get all happy and wealthy and prosperous, it tends to pull our heart away from the Lord. And when we get into pressure and problems and crisis, we begin to call out to God for help. I think crisis and problems is one way it kept the Israelis trusting in God. And here you see the beautiful nature of God's care and love. Though they're unfaithful, God's faithful. Though they continue to rebel and break His covenant, God's faithful to His covenant. Though they go a-whoring after other gods and other idols, God's willing to bring them back. But it didn't last. Somehow the kids didn't catch the faith of the parents. And this terrible cycle of godlessness continues over and over. May it not be so in our day. May we learn from the things of the Old Testament. May we pass on to our kids dynamic faith. May we see crisis and problems for what it is, a time for us to draw near to God and strengthen our faith. He is with us. He loves us. He cares for us. He will not leave us. Hallelujah. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again. Same time, same place, next week. God bless you.